Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. And producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We're recording on Wednesday morning. And for those of you who don't know, we have a second congressional congressman, Annie Custer. Annie Custer has been around for quite a long time. Annie Custer just announced that she is not running for Congress again in the second congressional district. It is throwing the entire state of New Hampshire in an uproar. It literally just happened literally 10 minutes ago, just before I begin to record my show. I just want to remind everyone that in New Hampshire, we're in an interesting bifurcated state. The Republicans control every aspect of state government, and the Democrats control every aspect of the federal government, in the sense that we have two Democratic U.S. senators, we have two Democratic members of Congress. So I'm telling you right now, between the election of 2024 for president and what is happening here, Annie Custer's decision not to run is sending shockwaves. I am not disappointed that she's not running. I think that's a fine idea. But I just want to let you know that that's happening, and we're such a unique state. And before I grab my first guest, I always start by something, and this was not my intent to start with Annie. But I want to start with the bridge collapse in Maryland. And I wrote the following. I wrote, "Let me note who was repairing the bridge in Maryland as it collapsed." Quote, "The Mexican consulate in the region said late Tuesday, the six missing workers included Mexican, Guatemalan, and Salvadorian people. They didn't say undocumented, but I think it may be implied. And then I wrote, "We refuse to address our antiquated immigration policy. We terrorize Americans about the migrants coming across the border. But it is those same migrants that will repair our roads, rebuild our bridges, work in our restaurants, take care of our aging parents. Ah, but let's keep demonizing them. And in the end, we will invite the demise of America. This is not about asking folks to change, but asking them to open the door essential for our economic survival." And then one last point, and then I turn to my fabulous first guest. And that is, you've heard me tell this story a million times, I will tell it a million and one. We were in New Orleans right after Katrina. We were there to help rebuild. We were there, and they were selling t-shirts in New Orleans. And this is what the t-shirt said, everyone. FEMA, find every Mexican available. Because who rebuilt New Orleans after Katrina were thousands of folks that were both undocumented from Latin America and Mexico. And the administration, the Bush administration, winked and nodded. But if you were walking around New Orleans right after Katrina for the next year and a half, you only heard one language, and it wasn't English, it was Spanish. So I just want folks to know, as we look at this bridge and we look at the money that we're spending on infrastructure and the remanufacturing and all the things we need to do with the climate crisis, how the hell are we gonna rebuild this bridge without finding people who will help us do it? And we are what? Demonizing the essential people that could actually make it happen. Anyway, with that, I will get off my high horse. Joining us right now is one of my absolute favorite people on the entire planet. He is one of the best writers. He's one of the best talkers. Slate.com is very lucky to have him. His name is Mark Joseph Stern. He writes a lot about the judiciary. And of course, what was he writing about? But the Supreme Court's recent, two cases that they were hearing. One is on mifepristone, and the other, basically, I think what Mark, the other, so mifepristone was one, and what was the Murphy case? Was it about, you know, allowing the feds to basically say to Facebook and whatever, you're putting up misinformation, you could be killing people, please don't put this misinformation up. And they were being questioned about whether they were actually abridging the First Amendment. So Mark Joseph Stern, there isn't anything you don't talk about that I don't want my audience to know, but let's start first with the mifepristone case, because I am frightened by what I see. It was everything that everyone said when they came down with the Dobbs decision, that was just the camel's nose under the tent. And yet this case that came out of the Kaczmarek court is something that is both not surprising, but at the same time terrifying, because while it appears the justices may have been rolling their eyes, you know there'll be another case coming down the pike where maybe this conservative court will weigh in and we will lose our right to mifepristone and maybe even things like birth control. So welcome to the program, Mark.
Thank you. I wish one day I could come on to talk about good news, but for now, we're still talking about the war against reproductive freedom. And this Supreme Court case was a real bellwether, because I think even the fact that this is at the Supreme Court shows how far we've come in a bad way, right? Because this is not a case about red state laws. This is about the ability of providers in blue states to provide medication abortion to their own patients lawfully under the federal regulatory regime that has allowed for this drug to be on the market since the year 2000, and in recent years has made it significantly easier to obtain because all of the data, all of the science, all of the studies show that it is safe and effective, safer than Viagra, which I know we'll talk about, safer than Tylenol, safer than so many drugs that you have in your medicine cabinet. So, you know, we can get into the details, but I think the top line that I want to get across for now is that the war on abortion, many people from sort of the past generation still think about this as back alley abortions, coat hangers, whatever. But the reality is that nearly two-thirds of abortion patients today take medication to terminate their pregnancies. That is what the anti-abortion side is focused on now. That is what they are going after. If Trump wins a second term, that will be a day one action to try to ban medication abortion across the country. This is where the fight will be moving forward. And so that is why somehow in the year 2024, the Supreme Court is having arguments about whether patients should have access to a drug that was available in the year 2000 and has been upheld across five presidential administrations since then.
And let me remind everyone that, you know, we think this is a story about mifepristone. Well, I know that it's not. Why? Because the biopharma industry has lined up on the government side. So explain to my audience why, for the first time, Big Pharma, which we don't necessarily like, is joining arms with the government about this case, because we think this is about mifepristone. The potential here opens the door to so much incredible abuse. My audience needs to understand, folks, this is not about whether you can get an abortion, about this drug that you can get through the mail, about whatever it is. This is really about whether the biopharma industry can actually rely on the FDA to approve their drugs, because some lunatic person could say, well, I'm going to question it. And guess what? They've just opened this door. This connection is so important because people need to understand it's a much bigger umbrella than just mifepristone.
Exactly right. So, you know, the FDA's drug approval process is universally called the gold standard. Other countries follow it. As soon as a drug is approved by the FDA, it's considered safe and effective around the world. It has for decades. It's the system that Congress set up. It's guided by scientific expertise. It's largely free from political pressure. It's even largely free from financial pressure, which in our system in America is quite unusual, right? It's not easy to game. And so the way it works, of course, is that, you know, a drug takes years to bring to market. It has to go through all of these safety trials. It has to be proven effective. And there have to be all of these studies and whatever. And finally, the FDA grants its approval. And that means that it's legal around the country as a general matter. It's legal under federal law. Doctors can prescribe it. Now, with mifepristone, it's a little different because after Roe fell, many states ban medication abortion, right? So here we're mostly talking about blue states. But the problem is, and you got to this immediately, I think it's really important. These doctors in the case, they're not prescribing mifepristone, right? They're not providing it to their patients. They oppose abortion, but they say, we see other doctors prescribing mifepristone to their patients, and we don't like that. So we are going to bring a lawsuit challenging the FDA's approval of mifepristone, as well as various actions making it easier to obtain, second guessing the FDA's scientists, second guessing the experts who have been tasked by Congress with determining what medications are safe, seeking a judicial decree blocking the approval of this drug and approval since then all around the country, because courts understand medicine and science better than medical and scientific experts. And that has never happened before in the history of this country. Yes. Never, ever, ever never. Before has a court held that the FDA should not have and could not have approved a drug as safe and effective when it did. Why has that never happened? Because never before has a court had the arrogance to assume that it knew better than FDA's scientists and experts about what drugs should be on the market and what drugs shouldn't. And I think one really great example of why that hasn't happened before and why it should be happening is that the lower court judge here, the district court judge, Matthew Kaczmarek, He is a Trump appointee, an anti-abortion activist, right? He went through the FDA's reasoning and said, well, I think it's wrong, and cited these studies that purported to show that mifepristone was unsafe and ineffective, and went on this rant about how it was so dangerous for women based on these studies. And guess what happened after his opinion came out? Those studies were retracted. They were withdrawn from publication. They were completely rebuked and rebutted. They were untrue. They were false. This judge was duped by misinformation that he wanted to believe because it led him to a place that he wanted to get, which was anti-abortion. So this is a case before the Supreme Court now asking, in large part, can judges do that? Can judges simply say, I don't like the FDA's decision here, so I'm going to override it and pull a drug from the market? And if the answer is yes, then no drug is safe. Because
exactly, no drug. This is
zero drug.
I want the bumper sticker to say, if they take away mifepristone, no drug is safe. They can take your drug away next. This is so, so important.
Any drug, statins, blood pressure medication, Ozempic that everybody's taking now, all of these drugs, anything you can think of, whatever's in your medicine cabinet, if it's been approved by the FDA, if this decision is upheld, then any doctor can walk into court anywhere in the country. They can shop for their judge, as happened here, right? They can say, I want this judge,
Merrick,
and obtain a nationwide order from one man saying this drug is now illegal across the country, whether it's your blood pressure medication or your diabetes medication, your HIV prevention medication, your birth control. Any of it can be ripped off the market, even if it has been legal and available for decades, as the abortion pill has. And so what's at stake? And this is why the biopharma industry has lined up on the side of the government. What's at stake is the reliance of not just this country, not just this system, but the entire world on the FDA's gold standard drug approval process. Can a single judge override the determinations of experts? And the answer should obviously be hell no.
Well, you know, I want the biopharma industry to step up and start running ads. I'm sorry. The way we educate is we get told over and over and over again what is really happening here. And they're going to hide behind mifepristone, and they're going to hide behind abortion, and they're going to hide behind. It is so much more toxic. It is so much more frightening than that. And frankly, the people whose financial profits are on the line is big pharma. And you know, there are times we hate big pharma, but when you need that drug, you need that drug. And if all of a sudden, and again, remind my audience about the folks that were being represented by the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is that far right Christian nationalist organization that represented the plaintiffs. Because I think what is so important, I think there were even dentists that were numbered of the plaintiffs. I mean, doctors, that was like unbelievable. But we start with the idea that mifepristone is probably safer, or is safer than Viagra and Tylenol. Okay,
yes.
And I'm gonna start issuing bumper stickers that say that mifepristone is safer than Viagra and Tylenol. I want a bumper sticker that says that. But given that these are doctors, remind my audience once again how remote the possibility is that they would, in any way, shape, or form, have to address anything dealing with mifepristone, because frankly, I'm looking at it and it's like 1/1,000,000th of a potential for this to happen. And then again, it couldn't happen. Remind myself how it is just so specious, because this concept of standing, I mean, that Kaczmarek would let them in his courtroom tells you he's an unlawful judge. The fact that the Fifth Circuit would actually even acknowledge this case, and now it's before the Supreme Court, is about such a distortion of who has a right to even be in that courthouse. And that's the part that actually blows my mind.
So these doctors, as I said, they don't prescribe this drug. They simply oppose it on ideological grounds. And their argument for how they're harmed, because remember, you know, you can't just waltz into court and file a lawsuit. You have to prove that you're harmed. That's a constitutional requirement. They say, we are afraid that some other doctor will prescribe mifepristone to some other patient to terminate a pregnancy, that their pregnancy will not be fully terminated, that they will have complications, which are, by the way, extraordinarily rare. Mifepristone is so incredibly safe, and effective. I cannot overstate how rarely there are serious complications.
I
And
know.
this was discussed yesterday. Sometimes women will go to the emergency room because they'll be facing heavy bleeding, but heavy bleeding is part of the process of an induced miscarriage. And frequently in those situations, they're told, look, this is just how the process works. It's an induced miscarriage. There's a lot of bleeding. So rarely is there actually an event that requires something like a blood transfusion or something that threatens the patient's life. I mean, it's just basically unheard of because it turns out that miscarriages in the first trimester are very common, very safe, and medically speaking, not a risk to the patient's health in general. So these doctors say that one of those patients is somehow going to be brought to the brink of death by mifepristone. And then they will walk into this doctor's emergency room, one of these anti-abortion doctors. There are only seven of them who are named plaintiffs in the case, by the way. So
Right.
one of these seven doctors who oppose abortion will find one of these unheard of mifepristone patients on the brink of death, walking into their emergency room with an incomplete abortion, saying, "You have to terminate my, you have to finish my abortion. You have to end the unborn life inside of me," which has never happened. We cannot find
Yes.
any evidence that this happens. And at that point, the doctor will have to terminate the pregnancy and feel complicit in doing so. Now, let's be clear, Arnie, there are federal and state laws that guarantee doctors the right not to be complicit in abortion. And if that ever happened, these doctors could simply throw their hands up and say, "I refuse to be complicit in abortion. I'm asserting my conscience rights," and they would be fully protected by law. But these doctors say, that's not enough. We are not satisfied with our own right to exempt ourselves from assisting someone who has already started an abortion. We think that to get full relief, we need a nationwide ban on this drug, or at a bare minimum, in this case, severe restrictions on access that would put it out of reach for a huge number of women in much of the country. That is their theory of standing. That is a theory that has been shut down time and again by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has said you cannot use some remote statistical probability to establish standing. You have to show a concrete and immediate and real-world harm. But that is the theory that Matthew Kaczmarek accepted. It's the theory that the Fifth Circuit accepted, and it's now the theory facing the Supreme Court.
So let me read from your piece because I want to get you into this next level. And you wrote, predictably on Tuesday, with a case built of vapors, as we just heard, to work, Alito and Thomas went full Comstock. Okay, Mr. Stern, explain to my audience what you mean by full Comstock, because this ancient law has become now revived. And if we know Alito and Thomas are looking for an out, it's the Comstock Act that they're looking to. So explain to my audience what you're talking about.
So in the 1870s, there was this puritanical censor crusader named Comstock who decided he didn't like women's rights. So he persuaded Congress to enact this law that was designed to censor the mail and any kind of transportation of information or goods. And it bans in the mail, it bans any kind of feminist literature, women's rights literature, it bans any kind of promotion of birth control, it bans birth control. And it purports to ban drugs that induce or cause abortion. Now, I do want to be careful here. This is a very poorly drafted law. It's been partially repealed, and it's unclear whether the law actually bans drugs designed to cause any abortion or drugs designed to cause an illegal abortion. So there's a real kind of dispute over the right reading of the text. But the plaintiffs in this case read it very broadly, and they say that mailing or transporting or carrying any abortion pill is a federal felony under the Comstock Act of 1873, a zombie law that has not been enforced in more than a century, that courts have consistently narrowed whenever they've addressed it, that Congress has repealed much of, though not this particular provision. And Alito and Thomas fully embraced this theory and basically said, hey, even though we understand that these plaintiffs might not have standing, we are ready, willing, and able in the next case to say that the Comstock Act bans medication abortion nationwide and maybe even bans all abortions nationwide because this zombie law needs to be revived and brought back to life and repurposed as a new federal ban on abortion in all 50 states.
I'm terrified, but I'm not just terrified because what they were suggesting by going full Comstock, because they were like mortified by the idea of standing, which they could not really figure out, but they knew that they had a back door, and Comstock was the back door. But remind my audience about Project 2025, because we've now been beating the drum about Project 2025, practically talking about it almost every week, Mark, okay? Because if you look at Project 2025, that is the agenda for the Trump administration. Trump doesn't do policy, the Heritage Foundation does. And if you look at Project 2025, you know exactly where they're going. And the whole idea of banning abortion and reviving the Comstock Act and all these things, they're literally lifted right out of Project 2025. So what we're hearing coming out of Alito and Thomas is not some remote idea. It's actually written in a policy document because that's where they want to go.
Exactly right. They are not hiding this. They are not hiding it at all. So Heritage got together with a bunch of other conservative groups and put out a nearly 1,000-page document. By the way, this mysteriously went offline yesterday, but I found an archival link to it. So don't worry, we still have access to it. That has a list of action items for Trump to do on day one if he wins on January 20th, 2025. And one of those action items is to sign an executive order that, quote, clarifies that the transportation, mailing, carrying, anything of abortion pills in any way, shape, or form is already a criminal offense, a felony offense under federal law, and that the attorney general, so Attorney General Josh Hawley or whoever, can bring criminal penalties, can imprison any abortion provider, even in deep blue California or New York, can imprison them for sending, prescribing, mailing, shipping abortion pills to anyone, anywhere. That is right out there in the open. That is what they are saying. And I want to go a little step farther, okay? Jonathan Mitchell, who argued for Trump in the insurrection case, who is one of Trump's top attorneys, he says that doesn't go far enough. Because the Comstock Act doesn't just talk about drugs that can cause abortion. It talks about any tool or item or thing that can cause an abortion. So he says it's not just pills. It's a speculum. It's an IV bag. It's any medical equipment that is going to an abortion clinic. All of that is also a felony offense under federal law. So every single abortion that is provided in this country is already illegal under the Comstock Act. And Trump's day one agenda has got to be to announce that he will start prosecuting immediately, because Congress doesn't have to lift a finger for that to start happening, to start throwing abortion providers in prison.
How do you practice medicine? How do you practice medicine if you can't send an IV bag through the mail? How do you do it? Think about what you were just describing. All those tools that we're describing are not just tools for abortion. They are tools for practicing medicine. I mean, this is such a slippery, slippery slope that it just shocks me. But I want to make sure that people didn't think that you were throwing a line away when you talked about possibly Josh Hawley as the attorney general. And the reason why you chose the name Senator Josh Hawley is because the person who is the lawyer in the case that the Supreme Court heard, the ADF lawyer, her name is, oh my goodness, Erin Hawley. So it turns out that the wife of Josh Hawley is the Erin Hawley-esque who actually is arguing this case. I mean, the case that has no standing grounds. It should never have gotten to the Supreme Court. But look at how we're connecting the dots to Donald Trump, to Project 2025, to Josh Hawley, and ultimately how extreme they're planning to go.
Yeah. Erin Hawley, Josh Hawley's wife, top lawyer for Alliance Defending Freedom, the far right Christian nationalist group that cooked up this case, close ties to Leonard Leo, to the entire network of Federalist Society donors and funders. They're all in the same bucket, right? They're all sloshing around in the same bucket. They all have their eyes on the prize. And what is the prize? To end what they see as the baby Holocaust in 2025 by getting Trump in the Oval Office and saying, we don't need Congress to do anything. This stuff is already illegal. Josh Hawley is on board. I think he is gunning for an appointment in the next administration very clearly. I think his wife is too, or maybe a judgeship. You know, all of these folks are auditioning for the next administration to try to get into power. Matthew Kaczmarek, that district court judge, he wants to be on the Supreme Court. Everybody knows it. They are all looking to the next step of this. And so anyone who's still looking behind, thinking about what happened in the past. They are so far ahead of you. They are so beyond overturning Roe. They are ready to have the courts declare that Comstock bans all abortions. They are ready for fetal personhood. They are ready to ban IVF through the courts. They have an agenda. It is out there in the open. And if you don't see it, it is because you choose not to see it. It can sound crazy because it's so extreme, but all I am doing here is quoting from their own documents and policy statements.
Mark Stern, it's not a baby Holocaust. It's a Holocaust on women. Because when you begin to play this out and recognize who will be sacrificed as a result of their absolutely futile agenda, it is virtually every female who has the potential ever to give birth. And I'm just telling you, look at your daughters, look at your nieces, look at this family. These are the women that they plan on sacrificing, because this is not about protecting life. This is not about protecting life. I am so glad we gave you all this time. Mark Joseph Stern is one of the best writers at Slate.com. Read everything he and Dahlia Lithwick write. But more importantly, if you hear he's going to be on TV or on the radio, you just sit down and you take notes. Thank you so much for doing this, Mr. Stern. I really appreciate it. Okay,
thank you, Arnie.
Ciao. You're welcome. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back. Welcome back to part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. If it is the final Thursday of the month, you know what it is. It is time for Race Class with Jonathan Feingold, a professor of law at Boston University Law School. We begin our show every month by reminding you that legislation restricting the teaching of race and racism in public schools and government entities has spread across the country. In our effort to respond, Boston University Law Professor Jonathan Feingold and myself, Arnie Arneson, are offering Race Class, a once-a-month course / conversation where listeners can hear what it's like to approach race and racism from a place of curiosity and history rather than fear and anxiety. And I think that last line is so important, that we approach these issues through a place of curiosity and history rather than fear and anxiety. And if I think about higher education, especially, or frankly, public education, it is a place where we're allowed to be curious, okay? In fact, that kind of curiosity should be encouraged, which I have to tell you, Jonathan, is why I so hate the concept of vouchers and charter schools and, you know, education freedom accounts and homeschooling, because what they lack is that they will, in fact, sometimes restrict that concept of curiosity. And they will encourage, unfortunately, fear and anxiety, because I see the idea of vouchers as a return to segregation. I see vouchers as a way to sort of minimize what our children are able to learn and who they're able to learn from and the expansive knowledge that they really need to go into the future. So to a large extent, Race Class is so important, and it should be almost a concept that we see in every school in America. So let me welcome you to your program and start by saying this was your pitch to me. Pro-Israel Jewish organizations are amplifying anti-Semitism on campus. Pro-Israel Jewish organizations are amplifying anti-Semitism on campus. I read that headline, I'm like, wait a minute, what are you talking about? But of course, I kind of know what you're talking about, and I think this next half hour will explain it. But as we look at the whole situation going on in Gaza, as we look at the inhumanity, as we look at the horrific events of Hamas, as we look at both, I think, in a lot of ways, Bibi and Hamas need each other, because both of them so not want a two-state solution. Both of them want to obliterate the other, okay? And they need each other. It's almost like it's this incredibly toxic relationship. But every time you raise any criticism about the leadership of Israel, you are accused of being anti-Semitic, Jonathan, and you know that, and that's in part why we're having this conversation. So let me tell you what I say over and over again, and what it is not uncommon for me to post on my Facebook page over and over again. And this is what I write. Israel is not a synagogue. Israel is a nation. Let me repeat. Israel is not a synagogue. Israel is a nation. And so therefore, when I am critical of Israel, I am not critical of Judaism. When I am critical of Donald Trump's administration, the potential of what might happen after 2024, it is not that I don't love America, but I am horrified by the actions of the leadership. So again, I think in some ways that's almost like the wallpaper in the background as we begin our conversation. So let me welcome you back to the program and explain to my audience why you've decided to take up this topic under the rubric of race class, because I think it's important for us to connect these dots. So thank you.
Thanks, Arnie. It's very nice to be here. I just had some cold brew and I'm feeling a little amped up. And so we might get a little amped today. Though maybe not. It's a very dreary day in Boston and I was up too late last night. So on vouchers, so in a sense, it's all connected. So vouchers, whatever New Hampshire calls their Freedom School accounts. Part of it is this ideological project to counter very modest inclusionary efforts that exist in at least some public education spaces. But it's also a massive grift. So there's a recognition that there's billions of dollars, 6 or 7 billions of dollars in our public education system. And there are moneyed interests who want that money. And there's an ongoing strategy to get at that money. And so I think it's important to appreciate the economic incentives that are driving efforts to funnel public money, our tax dollars, into the hands of folks who want to privatize public education, not just for some ideological purpose, but because they want that cash. But so you asked this question. So I will spend a couple minutes framing our conversation today before getting into the specifics of it. And I know that we are not going to have enough time to really get into a lot of what I want to talk about, which is okay. We can continue this conversation another time. You sort of shared this like pitch that I shared with you, and I've since tweaked it. So now it reads, pro-Israel Jewish organizations manufacture the new anti-Semitism. And part of the reason, and so you ask, well, why is Race Class, this program, this podcast that we call Race Class, engaging questions about anti-Semitism? And one answer could be that, especially if you're someone who is familiar with the work of Eric Ward, you appreciate the deep interconnection between anti-Semitism and white nationalism, and appreciate how anti-Semitism and a lot of the ideology, sort of the old school anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, fuel and animate white nationalist movements in different respects. And so you really cannot be a fully well-rounded anti-racist scholar or scholar of racism, anti-Black racism, unless you really understand how anti-Semitism fuels ideologically and otherwise white nationalist movements. That's one piece of it. That's less sort of our immediate focus today. Another is sort of ask the question, so why me? Why would I be having this conversation? And I'm asking that not as a question of sort of personal identity or experience. I am Jewish American, as you know, and someone who'd be racialized as white. But I am not a Middle East expert. And our conversation right now is not about Middle East policy per se. But what I am is someone who has read a lot about the process of racialization and how race functions and travels and operates domestically, and how particular identities can be flattened and essentialized in ways that lead to all sorts of bad outcomes, you could say. And so part of my question personally recently has been, how can I draw on the analytical resources that I have, that I have cultivated through years of, you know, hard work and reading a lot and getting things wrong and understanding things more, to try to understand a ongoing phenomenon that is happening right now in the United States that has to do with a particular manifestation of what I think of as a sort of new anti-Semitism and the complicity that I see in pro, like ostensibly pro-Israel as currently constituted Jewish organizations, or right-wing Jewish organizations, this relationship. And so it's a question of how can someone who's a race scholar begin to understand and parse through and unpack what's happening right now in this moment. And so today's race class is going to be a little bit different than some past episodes, where normally the episode is a fully formed thought. This is meant to be sort of a look inside the process, where I am going to share how I am currently in a dynamic, far from static way, trying to draw on frameworks and concepts that I am familiar with to understand, diagnose, and parse through something that's happening in real time. And so I'm being very clear. I do not have, like, I have sort of hypothesis slash theory and instincts and tools, but this is not the end of any sort of conversation. And so that is the backdrop. And let me share a little bit more where this is coming from. For the past months now, I have received a steady trickle of emails, of texts from family and friends who are Jewish, that link to or sort of point to articles, often in our mainstream press, that make two claims. The first is this claim that anti-Semitism is on the rise, which is a descriptive claim, sort of claim that the world as it is. The second is the claim that progressives are to blame, which is a, you can think of it as a causal claim as to sort of explaining why anti-Semitism is on the rise. I am deeply skeptical about both claims, particularly when they're paired in this way. And here's why I'm so skeptical. A, and we've talked about this, many of the individuals who are utilizing, leveraging their bully pulpit to proclaim that anti-Semitism is on the rise are folks like Elise Stefanik and Marjorie Taylor Greene. That's her name, Marjorie Taylor Greene?
Yeah,
Never actually said it out
MTG.
loud. Never MT, I've never said it out
I've
loud. It
said it too
sounded weird in
often.
my
Go
head.
on.
So they're the ones, they are among the folks who are raising, quote unquote, like alarm bells about anti-Semitism, yet they are deeply embedded in Christian nationalist projects right now, very comfortable with great replacement theory, with all sorts of manifestos that are openly anti-Semitic in the old school ways. And so I'm deeply, I think it'd be weird not to be deeply suspicious when they are on the front lines making that claim. And the second is this notion that anti-Semitism is rising and progressives are to blame, DEI to blame. That is verbatim what folks like Chris Rufo are marshaling.
Articulate.
And so you should know, Arnie, that I was talking with someone, a colleague recently, as to why I'm so skeptical and saying how I'm concerned when mainstream media, when folks sort of in the middle, on the left, concede any ground that sort of progressives are to blame for anti-Semitism because it is literally reproducing the talking points of right-wing entities like Heritage
Exactly,
Foundation, who we know just like met with Viktor Orban. But their response was, you know, John, I like you, but you sound like a conspiracy theorist. And so, and I was caught off guard in part because all I'm doing is quoting folks like Christopher Rufo, who have been open for years now that what they are attempting to do through a concerted, well-funded, highly infrastructure communications campaign is stigmatize everything that is inclusionary, progressive, et cetera. And so I am just going to quote Rufo a few times now so that anyone who is listening is like, John is being conspiratorial. It's like, no, I'm simply quoting
Take
Rufo.
them at their word. Take them at their word is what you're
So
suggesting. All right, what does Chris say?
a Politico article from January 3rd that was discussing Rufo's complicity in a campaign to remove Claudine Gay from Harvard. So question to Rufo. Do you think the playbook works on any issue, or do you think that the Israel-Palestine issue is unique insofar as it's already dividing elite liberal organizations? Rufo's response: I've run the same playbook on critical race theory, on gender ideology, on DEI bureaucracy. For the time being, given the structure of our institutions, it's a universal strategy that can be applied by the right to most issues. I think we've demonstrated that it can be successful. His strategy is the smear campaigns that he has openly and sort of celebrated the success of against stuff like quote unquote CRT. A tweet from Rufo from March 21st. We are driving the narrative yet again. Until Leadership Institute's reforms, people will think when people think quote unquote Harvard, they will think DEI, plagiarism, anti-Semitism, and scandal. Someone who is celebrating a successful smear campaign. Harvard Crimson article from February 24th. And there's like a little sort of framing, then goes into the quote. As criticism of Harvard's handling of campus anti-Semitism swelled and arguments connecting anti-Semitism to DEI gained purchase, Rufo and other conservative activists saw a chance to pounce. Rather than just criticize DEI for failing to properly support Jewish students, they could tear down DEI completely. And then the quote from Rufo: it provided this political opportunity for those of us who have been writing and speaking about this for years, this being sort of the anti-racism faction, to start mobilizing the new constituency against some of these ideologies. And so this is just all to say, when someone sends me an article that makes the claim either that anti-Semitism is spiking or that progressives are to blame, I react reflexively because I see a successful right-wing communications campaign that has infiltrated popular discourse, in part because many of the people who now instinctively sort of understand anti-Semitism to be rising or associate it somewhat with progressives in some amorphous or not way, they have no relationship to the right-wing propaganda. But that's a just signaling the effectiveness of the right-wing propaganda. But sorry, go ahead, Arnie.
No,
And then I
let me. I
wanted
just
to,
want to remind you use the term Chris Rufo like everybody. I mean, Chris Rufo doesn't have the same notoriety as Donald Trump or Joe Biden. So I just want to remind everyone a little bit about Chris Rufo because I want people to understand that when you use his name, this is who you are referring to. He is an American conservative activist. The reason you know the name Chris Rufo is because we've been spending a lot of time in Florida, okay, with Ron DeSantis. Remember his war on woke? Well, it turns out that he appointed Chris Rufo to be a board member at the college he was dismantling, known as New College. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research. His basic involvement with the Republican Party is his efforts to destroy and restrict critical race theory. When he realized that that was a little bit difficult because it was only taught in a couple of law schools around the country, they decided to morph into what? Into a war against diversity, equity, and inclusion. He has a bully pulpit. He gets repeated a lot. And as you describe, what he has done so successfully is if anyone raises any questions about the humanitarian horror going on in Gaza, if they suggest that Bibi Netanyahu is not leading appropriately and he himself is corrupt and is using this as a way to basically not have to address his sort of criminal background, it is now that you are not just being concerned about the Palestinian issue, you are now expressing an anti-Semitism position. They have now conflated the two, so you can't even speak about Gaza. You can't even mention anything without being assumed to then all of a sudden have sold yourself out, and you are clearly an anti-Semite. And I think that is what is so horrific, is that he's been so successful at connecting the dots. And frankly, let's be honest, AIPAC has helped, ADL has helped, and this is making it so difficult for people on college campuses to know what actually is real and what is Memorex.
And I hope no one has left the conversation because I'm going to take a maybe unpredictable turn. So there's a real risk in that accompanies the reflex that I always feel, the reflex to discount the claim, for instance, that anti-Semitism is spiking because that claim parallels what I think appropriately identify as part of a broader right-wing communications campaign. And the risk is that if one reflexively dismisses claims of anti-Semitism or concerns about anti-Semitism because they overlap with right-wing propaganda, you are prone to make both an analytical mistake and a political mistake. The analytical mistake is that overlap between a communications campaign and claims or concerns does not mean that there are not real legitimate concerns about anti-Semitism on campus and elsewhere, nor that they are necessarily on the rise. And one of the reasons why this sort of propaganda is so effective is because anti-Semitism is always a serious concern. And there's degrees to which that it is embedded within American society and globally. And so to simply dismiss can lead to a misdiagnosis, even if the reflex is inappropriate in some ways. And it can also alienate individuals who recognize and are most vigilant to anti-Semitism. I don't mean the sort of conflated anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, but acts of openly anti-Jewish bias, or the same sort of pervasive conspiratorial ideas that are always sort of floating around American society. And I want to make a little sort of analogy here that my colleague Vinay Harpalani, who is a sort of leading scholar on affirmative action in Asian Americans in the United States, often helps to remind me. So recent attacks on affirmative action, including the litigation against Harvard, you had right-wing individuals and networks who proffered this story that Harvard was discriminating against Asian Americans in order to malign affirmative action. It was very clear that Ed Blum centered Asian American identity specifically to stigmatize racial inclusion. Now, that led many civil rights groups to just simply reject the claim that that Asian Americans were confronting bias at Harvard or otherwise. Now, that makes sense to the extent that you are recognizing Ed Blum, Pacific Legal, and these other groups are engaged in a sort of instrumentally leveraging Asian American identity for ulterior purposes. But it leads to the analytical mistake, or at least to an analytical mistake, because there was evidence of anti-Asian bias.
Yes.
It was not the product of affirmative action, and we know that in part because wealthy white students tended to benefit, and arguably was not legally cognizable. But there is, analytically, we should be concerned if we are simply dismissing the claim or concerns about anti-Asian bias because folks sort of on the other side are trying to manipulating that for different ends. But it also...
But what they're using, Jonathan, what they're saying is that there is a kernel of truth in what they're saying. They're then taking that kernel of truth and then they're directing it for their agenda. They're not, I mean, it's not that they're not acknowledging what you and I both just said. You know, there is Asian bias, but it wasn't caused by affirmative action. But if there is Asian bias, and then you can use that to sort of divide and conquer, that's why they're so successful. And I just want to point out the idea of anti-Semitism. I ran for Congress in 1996, long before we had the issues going on right now. And guess what? Everyone thought I was a Jew, and I never corrected the record. And a U.S. senator told me, oh, Arnie, why didn't you tell people you weren't Jewish? You might have won the election. That was 1996. All right. So let's talk about anti-Semitism. It has been around for a long time. It is just isn't something that was just created. It doesn't only have to do with what, you know, you're hearing now with the arguments about what's going on between Gaza, Hamas and Bibi Netanyahu. That was 1996. I get it. I've lived it, Jonathan. I've lived it. So I think, again, we can't discount what is true. What we can do is see how it's being distorted and how it's dragging us in a direction that not only doesn't address the problem, frankly makes the situation a million times worse.
And so this is race class. We really, it is important to me that we are as precise as possible. And I'm not saying that you're not being, but and I'm also being mindful of time. So anti-Semitism obviously is a term that can mean a lot of different things. And so I want to circle. So I want to avoid the risk that I just identified, the risk of sort of the analytical mistake or the political mistake of just alienating friends and allies and family because of arguably an over reaction or reflex to discount because you know that some of the proponents of it are doing so in bad faith. And so I'm going to be really precise right now. And I want to make I'm going to offer a descriptive claim that I think is probably accurate. Students on college campuses whose dress or clothing signals Jewish identity, I think that right now they're more likely to encounter hostility or negative attitudes or like suspicion on campus. And so like an example would be someone who wears like a kippah or like a Star of David, like on a necklace. And these are symbols. This is like dress that is inextricably linked with Jewish identity. And so to be clear, I think that it would be inaccurate to suggest that right now in this moment, individuals who wear that sort of anything that signals Jewish identity are likely a little bit more vulnerable to hostility. But now this brings me to the causal question. The question is why? Because it might be that that is true, but then the second question is why is that true? And here's one of the so this is when I said, I'm currently trying to think through this dynamic right now. I think one of the driving causes are right-wing provocateurs, like the MTGs, and certain pro-Israel groups who have effectively shaped public discourse in a way that has hardened the cognitive association or link between Jewish identity on the one hand and Israel's current military policy on the other.
Exactly.
And so it's that when someone sees the symbol that is, for the person wearing it, a reflection of religious or cultural identity, what is experienced, what is perceived, is Israel's current atrocious, horrendous, indefensible campaign against Palestinians. And so how do I get there? And so I'm going to sort of unpack it a little bit by turning to Khalid Beydoun, who is a scholar of Islamophobia. Because so this is also where I'm situating myself, how am I trying to make sense of this? Well, I'm turning to frameworks and tools that I'm more familiar with to try to get a sense of what's happening right now. And so in his recent book, American Islamophobia, Professor Beydoun defines Islamophobia as follows. The presumption that Islam is inherently violent, alien, and unassimilable. Right. A presumption driven by the belief that expressions of Muslim identity correlate with a propensity for terrorism. And so that is where he is theorizing one of the ways in which Muslim identity is racialized, and individuals whose dress is publicly understood as an expression of Muslim identity are then vulnerable to a sort of anti-Islam sentiment, which is why Sikh Americans who are not Muslim but are mistaken for Muslim can be targeted in acts of sort of of Islamophobic acts. And so then it's like, how might we translate that definition or understanding of Islamophobia to the specific example that I'm offering, to the claim that students whose dress signals Jewish identity are more likely to encounter hostility, negative attitudes, et cetera. And so here I'm also, to be really precise, I'm thinking about, so I'm on BU's campus of Orthodox Jewish students who are anti-Zionist.
Yes, people
And
don't
so,
know that.
yeah,
That's
so
right.
Orthodox Jewish students who, and so based on their dress, they will be like clearly Jewish. And then the question is, well, what is one's presumption walking by about their politics because of that? And again, so I do think that there is a degree to which the right-wing Jewish groups have hardened this association between Jewish identity and right-wing Israeli politics. And part of it has occurred, I believe, through groups that, like you mentioned, ADL. I think among others, sort of both claiming and leveraging an authoritative Jewish perspective. And you can also think like Jewish organizations on campus that tend to have a sort of a monopoly over Jewish life or Jewish space. Engaging in discourse that again is linking Jewishness with his Israeli policy, which is it's Israel's assault on Gaza. Part of it is through the rhetorical claim that all anti-Zionism or pro-Palestinian speech, as you said, is per se anti-Semitism.
Right.
Because if that translates to a claim that criticism of Israel or Israeli leaders is anti-Jewish, then it erodes the space to conceptually distinguish between Jewishness and an openly anti-Palestinian agenda, which does not represent by any means all Jewish people or all Israelis, but seems to be the policy of the current Israeli government. And then you also have one, just one last. No, go ahead, Arnie. We're running out of
No,
time. Go
I
jump
we,
in.
I, we began we I began the show by saying Israel is not a synagogue. Israel is a nation. And what they are doing here, using the distortion of my concern about the behavior of Bibi Netanyahu, which is not about anti-Semitism, it is not anti-Jewish, it is about bad policy choices that undermine the safety and security of Israel, that frankly undermine now the safety and security of America, is that they're preparing me, if Donald Trump gets elected, not to challenge him. Because if I challenge him, I must hate America. If I challenge him, I must not be, I must not be a patriot. Understand what they're doing. They're connecting these dots so that they strangle me.